We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 304 relating to appraiser certification and licensure board. So we'd like to have anyone who wants to give public testimony that signed up. Oh, we have Roxanne Gillespie. If you'd come forward. I understand you're here this morning from Eugene.
Yes.
Mr. Vanetta, do you want to come up with Roxanne as well? And we'll take you both if that's okay. Good morning.
Good morning.
And if you'll state your name for the record and proceed.
Certainly. My name is Roxanne Gillespie. I live in Eugene, Oregon. I am an independent fee appraiser in Eugene, Oregon. Thank you for hearing me this morning. I appreciate it. I'm also the chairperson for the Appraiser Certification Licensure Board, and I have been the chairperson for the last 6 years, and I've been serving on the board at the governor's request for the past 8 years. The board has spent many months analyzing Senate Bill 304, and the board has come to a conclusion that we are in 100% support of 304. The board has appointed a 5-person transition committee that is actively working at researching and working together to make a transition smooth for the agency. The committee is comprised of 3 board members and 2 members from the Coalition of Real Estate Appraisers that was formed to draft this legislation. We are, as I said, we are in support of this bill and would encourage your support on it as well.
Thank you, Roxanne. The early 80s, I was a real estate appraiser. And lots of things have happened and changed since then. I would not qualify now, obviously. So appreciate your testimony this morning. Appreciate you coming up from Eugene. Any questions of Ms. Gillespie? Thank you.
No, but we really ought to ask Mr. Vanetta something, anything.
Yes. Mr. Vanetta.
I am Fred Vanetta, and I am appearing before you on behalf of the Greater Oregon Chapter of the Appraisal Institute. The largest of the appraisal associations in the state. In addition, the members of the coalition that have reviewed this bill and asked me to mention them in our support of it is the American Society of Appraisers, the Oregon Society of Farm Managers and Rural Appraisers, and the Rose City Chapter of the National Association of Independent Fee Appraisers, and the Oregon Appraisers Coalition of Eugene. So the best we can determine, there is broad support among the profession for the bill, and I know the Greater Oregon Chapter is very supportive of it, and we would encourage you to make appropriate modifications in the DCBS budget and send our bill to the Senate floor.
Thank you, Mr. Vanetta. Any questions?
Madam Chair, first of all, please let me apologize for my tardiness this morning.
Fine.
I'm turning 55 today, sometime this afternoon.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. And when you turn 55, and I know that you got a long time to take.
Oh, you're so there, diplomatic.
But when you turn 55, you just. You catch that that terrible disease, CRS, and I just can't remember stuff. That's what that is. And anyway, I can't remember stuff because it's not on my calendar, but people just want to walk down and visit about other things. So I did want to say that similar to Senate Bill 304, I also have a privatization or a semi-autonomous bill pending in the House that would provide semi-autonomy to the appraisal certification licensure board. I am a strong proponent of that degree of semi-autonomy so that we can have boards of professionals that can select their own leadership of professionals within their organization or people who understand and have been raised or who have been trained to come in and assist in the directorship of these kinds of boards. I think it's unfortunately too many times boards are run by default through programs based upon people working themselves up through the bureaucracy. And when we can have appraisers select their own boards or appraisers on the boards and then select their own management, we are in a much better position to have them managed. So I feel very strongly about this, but I wanted to make sure that the members of the subcommittee understood that I had a similar bill that does what Senate Bill 304 is. So I find myself in 100% wholehearted support for exactly what has been presented to you this morning.
Thank you, Representative Butler, and I certainly agree with you. Yes, Representative Hayden, any questions?
No, just that I could have said that in four words. I support it, too.
Very good, but it's not your birthday.
Yeah, besides that, you don't have CRS.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Gillespie, for coming to me, and we will schedule this for a work session at a later date, I am told by the staff. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we'll close the public hearing. I guess there was no one else. No one else was signed up. Okay. We'll close the public hearing on 304 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5507, Department of Consumer and Business Services. And we'll take public testimony on Senate Bill 5507 if anyone is signed up for that. If not, we'll have Debbie come forward and do the Oregon Medical Insurance Board.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Debbie Lincoln, Deputy Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Service. Just quickly for the record, the department too supports Senate Bill 304.
Thank you.
I'd like to introduce Rocky King, who is the administrator of the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, who will present the OMIP budget.
Good morning, Rocky.
Good morning.
Good to have you here.
Glad I think I won the lottery, the first to go this morning. That's
good.
And Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator for the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. And our presentation material starts, I believe, on page 96. And I'd like to just kind of give a real brief, before we go through some of the documents, a brief overview of the program so that you have a good grasp and understanding, I think, of what it is. If you live in LeGrand, you're an accountant or you're a hairdresser and you have asthma and you don't have insurance and you try to get health insurance, you will probably be denied health insurance unless you come to the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. If you live in Medford and you're enrolled with an HMO and you have diabetes and the HMO closes down and your group has no place to go and you have to go to the individual market, you'll probably be turned down unless you go to the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. If you are on Medicaid, welfare, and welfare reform in the state has been very successful, and you live in Portland and you work your way off of welfare, you're self-employed, or you work for a small business that does not provide health insurance, and you've had breast cancer, you're not going to be able to get insured unless you come to the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. And that really is what the mission is of what is called OMIP. The Oregon Medical Insurance Pool provides health insurance to Oregonians who, because of health conditions, have been turned down for coverage in the individual market, or people who leave group coverage and do not have what is called portability. That is, there's no market for them to go to except for the individual market, and they can come to us. And irrespective of their health conditions and health history, we can insure them. So we are basically a small insurance company run by the state of Oregon. We have a third-party administrator, Blue Cross Blue Shield, that administers the day-to-day functions of that program for us. And although administratively we're within the Department of Consumer and Business Services, we do have a board called the OMIP Board that, from a policy perspective, governs the benefits, the rates, the premiums, the selection of the third-party administrator, and kind of oversees the day-to-day management of the program, not the administrative piece, but the program management of the program. That board is made up of representatives of the consumer market. We have two consumers. We have insurance company representatives. We have a provider representative. And the director, Mary Neidig, of the department, appoints the board, and also her or her designee sits on that board. So we have a good stakeholder support in terms of how the program is run and who oversees that particular program. Premiums for the program are established based on the individual market. This is not an inexpensive program. That is, when someone enrolls in our program, we basically charge them a surcharge of 125% of what they would pay in the regular market. So they have to contribute a little bit more, about 25% more than you or I who have just a regular health insurance program. Portability market, for those people that are just losing their group coverage and have no place to go, there is no surcharge. They come in at just 100% what you and I would pay. And an interesting thing about the pool is that for every dollar we collect in premiums, we expend about $1.80 in claims. So we lose money, about 80 cents for every dollar we collect in the premium dollars from the insureds. And we make that up through what is called an assessment program of insurers throughout the state. Anybody who does businesses in the state and provides health insurance then must pay through an assessment process to help support the pool for these folks that can't get regular insurance. So our mission is pretty simple.
Rocky, yep. Representative Butler.
Excuse me, just one question. The $1 of income equals $1.80 in claims, and then your administrative costs are on top of the $1.80, or that includes the administrative costs.
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, our average loss ratio runs between 175 and 185%. We our administrative cost is about 7%. So if that $1.80 is about average over the last 10 to 12 years. So our administrative costs, when I talk a little bit about our missions, one of the things you'll see, Representative Butler, is our admin costs have been consistently at 7% or below for the last 12 years, which we're very, very proud of. So our mission is very simple, and that is to provide access to health care for folks throughout the state of Oregon and in all sectors of the state that have been denied coverage or have no insurance options because of health conditions. Our specific goals are to, and I'm on page 97 right now of the document, our specific goals are to increase awareness about the program. It amazes me, but every month we get 400 people that contact us and say, I'm uninsured for medical reasons and would like to come in. We enroll anywhere between 300 and 400 of those every month. And we've been going for 12 years. So it is just continually a challenge to make sure that we let people know about the program. We want to focus on customer service. We have, as a state program, we feel a little bit different obligation towards our customers sometimes than the insurance industry does. And we want to do a better job in focusing on customer service. We want to expand case management efforts. We have a case management program, but we want to take that one step further so that when somebody comes into our program, they're diagnosed as, for example, as having diabetes, rather than waiting for them to contact us, we want to do more frontline intervention with those folks to get them into diabetic education courses to make sure they're taking their medication and to prevent high claim costs down the road. We want to expand our options for prescription drug coverage. I think there isn't anybody in the state, any insurer in the state, or anybody who has insurance that doesn't understand or feel the impact of higher prescription drug costs. And finally, we want to do a better job of managing our data. I'll talk about that in a few minutes, but 12 years ago when we started this program, a half an inch data report came from our insurance carrier telling us what happened that particular month, and we were able manually to go through that. Now we get a printout that's about a foot and a half of data, and we just need to do something other than just manually review and compile that information. Our key successes, and I'll go through some charts with you at the end of this to kind of give you a picture, but our key successes are that we've gone from zero in 1990 to about 7,000 Oregonians that now are enrolled in this program, 6,920 at the end of last month. That's the highest enrollment we've had in the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool since its inception. Representative Butler, getting to your question earlier, our administrative costs have been consistently under 7% since our second year of operation in 1991. In 1990, our administrative costs was 28%. That was startup, and from then on it has trended and kept itself very low. And finally, one of our other key successes is the customer communications that we've expanded. We've gone out last year to eight or nine cities and met with our insureds And if you have Kaiser or Blue Cross or ODS or Pacific Care, how many public meetings have they held to talk about customer service, claims, premiums, benefits? They don't do that very often, but we decided to go out and actually have meetings with our insureds in 8 to 9 cities, and found that to be probably one of the highlights of my experience with this program over the last 10 years, listening to the day-to-day struggles that people have to get health care. Next biennium, what do we want to do? And I'm still on page 98, I believe. We want to expand the disease and case management services. We want to focus more on prescription drugs, and I have some charts that I'll share with you to show you what those costs have been and how they've trended higher. We want to improve our TPA, our third-party administrator contract administration. In 1990, we paid about $10,000 a month to have them manage this program for us. Now it's approximately over $100,000 a month. We haven't really expanded that many staff, and we need to do a better job of going up to ensure that the taxpayer, the insurer's dollar, and the insured's dollar, the people we serve, is being well spent and spent appropriately. We want to build a data electronic data warehouse so that we can get better view of the kinds of medical trends that we're seeing within our own program. We're going to expand the number of public meetings. Last year, we held 8 to 9 public meetings with our enrollees. We want to double that during the next year, so we get not only to Bend and LeGrand and to Medford, but we want to get to Astoria and Gold Beach and to Klamath Falls and John Day. It's easy to do the I-5 corridor. It's a lot more challenging to get out and meet with those folks in some of those rural areas, so we will do that better this year. Page 99, the key outcome and output measures. It's pretty obvious, you know, how many people are enrolled, what our administrative expense is, and Madam Chair, Representative Butler, that administrative expense is not only the state cost. The administrative expense includes the state and our third-party administrator cost. The state cost is about 2%, and our third-party administrator is about 5%. So we've been able to operate that at a pretty good level. But that's a key thing that we look at on an ongoing basis. And finally, the claims cost versus premium premiums received. And if you have I believe that you have packet that I gave you that has about 5 charts in that. And I just want to go through those real quickly because I think they give you a good view of the program. First of all, the majority of people in this program are women. You know, depending on how you come in, whether Medicaid, portability, or we have a large number of people that come in through the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. You've probably heard that referred to as FIOP. But about 60% overall of the enrollees are female. The average age is about 50 years old. Over 50% of the people have incomes below $25,000 a year. These are a lot of people out there that are just struggling, that generally work for businesses that do not provide health insurance or who are disabled and are low income but do not qualify for Medicaid. The top 10 reasons people come into the program: high blood pressure, diabetes, cancer, obesity, overweight, mental disorders, heart conditions, and none of these equal more than probably 5 or 6, well, I think only one, and that's high blood pressure, is at about 10%. 1 out of every 10 that come in. Diabetes is second. All these others represent less than 3 or 4% of those coming in. There's probably 200 different conditions that people enter the program for. We have 4 plans: a traditional indemnity, where you can choose any doc, go any place. 14% of the folks are in that plan, and it is the most expensive. A PPO, or preferred provider, 45%. That's offered in almost all counties. Managed care program, where we have limited counties, and that's just like the regular market. Managed care just isn't in Fox, Oregon. But it's in Portland, it's in Salem, the I-5 corridor, and the major metropolitan areas. And we have a low-cost, low-benefit plan that has a very high deductible. But for these folks who have very severe medical needs, that plan generally is not a very good option for them, unless it's just a bridge between one plan and another. The first chart gives you a history of our
Excuse me, Rocky.
Yes.
Representative Hayden?
It has a high deductible. Is it a catastrophic plan?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, it's a $1,000 deductible, and it does not have, for example, prescription drugs, so it is a very high deductible catastrophic plan.
But on the things it covers at the usual and customary fee?
That is correct, Representative
okay.
Hayden.
Thank you.
The first chart, which is the green one, shows you just our history. As you can see, we continue to grow, and the steep curve that you see in the last 3 years, I think, represents what's happening in the economy and in the fact that many businesses, especially small businesses, are starting to drop some of their coverage due to the rising cost of premiums. So you see a shift of some of these folks out of group business into the high-risk pool. The next chart shows the active members of March 31, 6920. The majority of those come through either the FEOP, which is the subsidy program run by the Insurance Pool Governing Board, which I also administer, but it is a separate state agency, and through medical eligibility. So between FEOP and medical eligibility, that comprises almost 70% of those that are 75% of those that are enrolled in the program. You see there medical Medicare. The state of Oregon and the federal government, and then later OMIP, passed a law that said if you have individual coverage and become eligible for Medicare at the age of 65 or due to disability, that previously they could kick you off of your, you know, if you're 65 and eligible for Medicare, almost all programs could say goodbye. And what we basically said, as long as you enroll in Medicare and as long as you get a supplemental coverage A or B, we will then allow you to keep your OMIP coverage if you can afford it. And that really helps some of those folks who have been enrolled in the pool for a long period of time who become eligible for Medicare, but maybe have had a transplant and have ongoing pharmaceutical needs, anti-rejection drugs that Medicare just does not cover. So we allow those folks, and it's a very small number, to stay in the pool. And their primary claim is for prescription drugs. The next chart shows you average claim and average premium, and this is per policy. It's $325 is our average premium per month. The average claims that we've paid in the last year is about $527 per month.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hayden.
Is that an individual premium or a family premium?
Senator Clarno, Representative Hayden, that is a premium per policy. And we have about 1.17 members per policy. So I don't want to say it's a family because you'd get the impression there were children there. But there are some adults where there are two 50-year-olds that are under the same plan. Very few. It does not pay them to put their children in the pool because you have the surcharge of 25%. You're better off to take the children and put them into the regular market if they're healthy because you don't pay a surcharge.
Well, Madam Chair.
Mr.
Hayden. Well, I'm just curious. I pay more than that. As a state employee, I pay more than that. But you say that you charge these people the 125% of the usual rate. This isn't 125% of what state employees are paying. It's less.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, your benefit package includes some things that our benefit package does not. It's a richer benefit package than what we would have. An example is ours, our HMO has a $1,000 deductible plan, our managed care plan for prescription drugs, no deductible for medical. Our PPO is a $300 deductible plan. So the deductibles and co-pays in our plans are significantly higher, I think, than the state plan.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I just had one observation.
Okay. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rocky, as I look at that premium chart, the $527 payout and a $325 average cost. I look back at the inception of the program. I think you said it was incepted in the 87 legislative session and then really got started a little bit after that. I noticed that the average claim to the average premium was basically 114%. That's the 155 on 177. And it appears to have gone up nearly in every year thereafter, maybe more slowly in some years than others. But we're at 162%. You mentioned that, you know, that it's approaching 180%. At some point, particularly with the medical costs going up, do you anticipate that percentage of differential going down or starting to level off, or is there some hope that this widening gap will start to slow down?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Butler, if you look at the first third of that chart, you're really talking about a new population. As people get into insurance, it's called aging of the pool. The longer they're in there, the older they get, the more health care costs they're going to have. So as long as we continue to take people in, that mitigates it, because those people coming in early in the first few years don't have a lot of claim costs. But after you've been there 3 or 4 years, those claim costs start to go up. When they first established the pool, Representative Butler, you're right, 1987 was the first legislation, 89 they kind of pushed it a little further, and 90 we implemented, they targeted a loss ratio of 200%. And the board has felt, I think, as well as the industry, that as long as we're within that 200% range, and there are 30 other pools throughout the country, then we're probably going to be pretty much on target. It starts going above that 200%, though, and there is going to be some concern. Other than a couple individuals throwing that loss ratio really out, when you're only a pool of 7,000, you get $1 million kid in there, or $1 million adult, and that can really, change those figures. Those aside, we have pretty well maintained that 160 to 180 loss ratio for the last 4 or 5 years, and the board has been pretty comfortable with that. If you look at the next page, it gives you a breakdown for medical eligible, those that come in under the subsidy program, and many of those people, by the way, are coming off of Medicaid, that lose their Medicaid, are turned down for health insurance in the individual market, and thus they become eligible for the subsidy program, and we put them in OMIP because they've been turned down. Portability, and also the Medicare. You'll see that since inception, we are a little higher in almost each one of those years in the year 2001 since inception. But it's really not that significant at this point. The last page, or the next to the last page, shows you just where our income comes from since inception and the current biennium. Again, premiums make up about 60%. Of the dollars, people pay their own way. And by the way, that's in addition to the copays and deductibles that they have to pay each month. The assessments pick up about 40%. We have some interest in other funds that come into the market. It's a little bit closer when you look at the current biennium, because the premium dollars have all been collected for this biennium. The assessments have all been collected for this biennium, but premiums we still have 4 months worth of premiums to put on the books, so that'll spread out a little bit there. The last page is to just show you prescription drug costs as a percentage of claims for the last 5 or 6 years. You'll notice in the right-hand corner the dot way up at the top. That's for those individuals that are eligible for Medicare but elect to stay in the pool while they're enrolled in Medicare. And for those folks, we basically pay nothing but prescription drugs. Medicare and their supplemental plans cover all other basic, most of their basic health care costs except for prescription drugs. So that's why that one up there is 60% is prescription. But we've been pretty in that 20% range for the last 5 or 6 years. If you went back 10 years ago, it would be between 8 and 10%. So like everybody else, we're seeing a large increase. So, Madam Chair, that's kind of the overview of our program.
Thank you, Mr. King, for your testimony. Any questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Butler.
I'd just like to go back to the next to the last slide there that talks about the premiums, including the copays and so forth, and the assessments. The assessments are against, originally I talked about some general fund assessments. Is there any general fund that's used here, or is this just assessments against insurance companies that are doing business in the state, or who do the assessments come from?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Butler, when we first started the program in 1990, $1 million of general fund seed money. That was one time only. After that, it was basically three things. Premiums from the insurers, assessments from the insurance companies. Twice a year, what our losses are going to be, and we go to the Blues and the Pacific Cares and the ODSs, and we say, here's your share. And they always smile and give their nod and send their check, and they don't like it, but they also support the program. So it's kind of, you know, the good and the bad. We also have some interest money because we do keep reserves to pay claims. And then the other funds, other than the general fund, and we do have, as you see in the current biennium, $258,000. OMIP, the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, oversees two other programs, the Insurance Pool Governing Board Small Business Program and the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. So part of my salary, part of my fiscal person salary, we have to do some rebates. I guess, what do they call that? Chargebacks to OMIP, or OMIP charges them for our administrative costs for overseeing those other programs. So the only fund really is a fund transfer from another agency.
So it's not general fund. It comes from the FEOP, which is a federally funded.
Represented by the tobacco tax fund.
Tobacco tax.
Yeah.
Representative Hayden.
Well, Madam Chairman, I'm impressed with the program. I think it's an important safety net, and I'm glad that we're doing it. I just want to point out that, as in many other fields, this is funded by cost shifting. It isn't the insurance companies that pay it. It is the rate payer, the premium payer, the individual. Just as when we go to the hospital and spend a day there, we wonder why our room rates are $500 a day, because of the cost shifting to the emergency room to cover people who can't pay. So we are cost shifting from the average citizen through the insurance company to this program to cover people who can't get into the regular programs. And I think it's necessary and good, but there's no free lunch.
True.
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, in fact, your premium, for example, as a state worker may be $400, we'll say. 56 cents of that $400 goes to support this pool. Our average assessment is about 56 cents over the last 10 years per month per insured in the state of Oregon.
Madam Chair, and I agree that that's a good value, Mr. King, but my accounts tell me that there are a multitude of 56 cents that I pay that actually add up to about 60% of my gross income that I pay to somebody or other. 56 cents adds up quicker than you think.
If it's more than once.
If it's more than once.
Thank you very much, Mr. King. Excellent presentation. And we'll close the public hearing and testimony on Senate Bill 5507 and open a work session on Senate Bill 5507. Satish, we'll get to you in a second. We're trying to get to the work session as we have a forum here. And we'll have a work session on the Workers' Comp Board.
Madam Chair, Workers' Comp Division.
We passed out the board last Thursday.
That's correct. It says Workers' Compensation Board, and I just read it.
My error. I apologize.
That's fine. Workers' Comp Division.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we did not complete the work session on this budget because of concerns about the budget reductions that were included in this division, and they are listed on page 44, and I'm wondering if the committee would like to have Debbie walk through with you what those Workers' Comp Division reductions are in package 090. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Debbie Lincoln again for the record.
And the reductions in the workers' compensation division that we're recommending due to shortfall in the premium assessment operating account include five positions and $831,000. Two of these positions, a manager and an auditor position, are in the investigative unit for $237,098. The unit our ability to do investigations will remain to some extent. We will reorganize how we do investigations, and investigations will continue at some level, but we are recommending the reduction of these two positions. We are also recommending reduction of services and supplies by $200,000, and this again is an effort to re-engineer our division practices and do our some online data access, which will allow us to reduce printed publications. And we are reducing the re-employment assistance units by three program representative positions. This is a $393,931 budget savings in the worksite modification program. The program will remain, it's currently a 9 FTE program, it will remain at 6 FTE. We are experiencing about a 34% decrease in activity in that program, and so we think that the impact, though there will be some impact, it won't be as great as it appears with the 3FT reduction. It also results in $1 million reduction in the workers' benefit fund, which is the money that's actually used to do the worksite modifications. So a total of five positions reduced, $831,029, two in the investigative unit and three in the worksite modification program.
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, I guess the question that I have, Ms. Lincoln, is you said that by reducing the folks in the investigatory unit that the program would continue at some level. I guess I'd like a little more specificity than that.
Yes, and John Schultz, who is here, was here, can give you the details on that. We do have the investigations unit is, trying to think how large it is right now, it's 6 or 7 FTE. So we will continue to do investigations. We're looking at a way to do a lot more in-office preparatory work before we go out to investigate. So we're going to try to re-engineer some of the way we do investigations. We continue to have people in that.
Sure.
Good. Here's John.
John, would you please describe? I thought it was my question that sent him bolting for the door.
Describe how the investigations unit will manage without those two FTE, please. I was fumbling badly.
She was covering for you very well. One minute. Where did you go?
For the record, I'm John Schultz, Administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, and I apologize for running out on you here. Something else had come up. I understand that you're...
Representative Johnson had a question.
I'll restate my question.
Thank you.
When Ms. Lincoln was explaining the reduction in the investigatory unit, she said it will continue at some level. I was looking for a little more reassurance than at some level. I don't know what those words mean.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, what we plan to do is basically reduce the number of staff that are involved in purely investigation function. There's two positions that are involved. One is a management position that was the manager of the investigation unit. The other position is an investigator position. Frankly, before getting into budget preparation and looking at the emergence of projected revenue shortfalls, we had a vacancy in the investigation unit that we were keeping open because the workload just was not there to justify filling the position. And when we began to look at projected revenue shortfalls,
we concluded that we could probably use our investigation staff more efficiently by marrying the investigators with our sanctions unit and our field audit unit. And so the proposal is basically to dissolve the entire investigation unit, but not get rid of the current investigators that we have, actually place them in some other units in our compliance section, and marry those investigators into the units where sanctions and penalties are provided. When we, for example, if we find that an example of a sanction would be if we find an insurance company is regularly paying benefits late, there's unreasonable delay in the payment of benefits, we would issue a sanction in regard to that. Oftentimes, we would have to send in an investigator in addition to field auditors to really try to investigate what is going on there. Sometimes it can be something just as simple as you've got people who are just involved in human error, but sometimes it can be more substantial than that. So the idea that we have with the investigation unit is, number one, by taking this small unit and disseminating the investigators into some of the other units that they work closely with anyways, like field audit and sanctions, they'll still be available to conduct investigations, but we can eliminate a management position. And then there was a vacant investigator position that, frankly, we think that we can continue to provide as many investigations as we do now without filling that position. And when we find ourselves, because workload in investigation does fluctuate, and when we find ourselves with a lot of investigations in some months, that we would draw in program staff to help conduct the investigations. We do that to a certain extent anyways. An example of that would be perhaps we're investigating a charge that an employer might be trying to fraudulently obtain purchases through the Preferred Worker Program. And that's a program that's set up to provide incentives and benefits to employers who hire workers who have permanently disabling injuries. And so there might be a set of equipment that we're providing to help this disabled worker perform a job function. We may get a report that an employer is really not getting that equipment for the injured worker. They're in essence trying to just obtain a capital expenditure for other uses. We might send out program staff instead of an investigator to do that investigation at a time when there's high workload. So I hope that is addressing your question.
Madam Chair, Representative John, two-part follow-up question. Was the manager position that you're eliminating a working investigator or purely management?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, it was purely a management position.
And the second question is, by using program staff to do the investigation work, will they be working out of class, and are the program staff adequately trained to do the important work of investigation? Is that an appropriate use of the program staff?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, we would see only using program staff to back up. They get involved in these investigations now because oftentimes there's very technical issues that only program staff may have the expertise to answer the questions on. So they consult with investigators now, often go out into the field with investigators to help with investigations now. So I really don't see it as the program staff would independently become investigators as much as they would augment the investigation staff that we have. We do have a lead investigator who would always be the person who would be coordinating the investigations.
The program staff work out of class at the point that they're doing investigatory work?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, no, they don't. It's the same classification.
Representative Gardner.
Madam Chair, just a couple of quick questions, John. One, most of the examples you use in the investigative unit are all complaint-driven. Do they only investigate in a complaint-driven system, or do they actually go out and do other audits, for instance?
Madam Chair, Representative Gardner, most of the things that drive investigators to go out into the field are typically complaint-driven, but they may come internally as well. We might determine that there's a pattern of abuse going on, but typically they're complaints that are coming in from the external world. We do have regular audits, of course, that we conduct that could turn up a pattern of abuse as well, but that's typically through our field audit unit.
Just one question. Currently, how often do you audit? I mean, I know, for instance, that if an insurance company is only late 80% of the time with their payment to individuals out there that are on workers' compensation claims, they're not in a fine structure. How often do you go out and audit for the four areas involved in that 80%?
Senator Clarno, Representative Johnson, we
I'm Representative Gardner, but that's okay.
Oh, excuse me, I'm sorry.
We don't mind.
Chair Clarno, Representative Gardner.
We're twin sons of different men. Okay.
Excuse me. There's two basic time periods. We do a quarterly audit that's frankly just on a very short amount of payments. For example, the timeliness of first payment of compensation, and that's done on a quarterly basis. The in-depth audits are done on a triennial basis, and what I mean by that is every 3 years we go out to insurance companies and do a more in-depth audit. Audits that are for the worker benefit fund expenditures are annual audits.
But just one more, Madam Chair. With this particular position, then you could, something you do in every three-year audit, you could actually do a more frequently with this kind of a position, couldn't you?
Chair Clarno, Representative Gardner, if that position was a field audit position, certainly.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if you would turn to page 2 on the spreadsheet that I had given you, I will walk through my recommendations. First of all, a recommendation that you approve the revised current service level of $29,610,457 other funds and $3,250,221 non-limited other funds, and 238 positions and 237.46 FTE. This includes a reduction of 182,153 for PERS and standard assessment rate reductions, and the reduction that we were just discussing of 831,029 in 5 positions. Moving on, Legislative Fiscal Office is recommending approval of Policy Option Package 131, Information Technology Support, of 281,096 other funds and 2 positions in FTE. I believe we discussed earlier the fact that this had been reviewed by the Subcommittee on Advancing E-Government and that they had approved this package. LFO is also recommending an amended budget note, and the amendment is very simple. The initial budget note talked about initiatives within the Workers' Compensation Division. I am recommending striking within the Workers' Compensation Division and directing the agency as a whole to report back to the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology. So the recommendation would be to strike in the 4th line of that budget note the phrase within the Workers' Compensation Division.
And I'm assuming we have approval of that from the co-chairs?
Yes, and from the committee that the Advancing E-Government Committee also approved it. It simply broadens the recommendation. Legislative Fiscal Office is also recommending approval of the 1% reduction in out-of-state travel, which is $740. And with that, Madam Chair,
Legislative Fiscal Office recommends approval of a budget of $29,890,813 other funds, $3,250,221 non-limited other funds, 240 positions, and 239.46 FPE.
Madam Chairman, I move the legislative fiscal recommendation of the current service level on the policy option packages as discussed and presented by Legislative Fiscal Office for a total budget for the Workers' Compensation Division of $33,141,034 and 239.46 FTE, 240 positions.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Any discussion? Representative Butler.
Just a simple comment, Madam Chair. I'm just still not convinced of the necessity for the reduction in the investigation unit or the worksite modification program. So that'll just be a noted as no desire to hold this up or anything, just to simply vote no.
Thank you, Representative Gardner. Any further discussion? Any objection other than Representative Gardner? If not, so moved. Next, we will have, in the work session, we will have the Oregon Occupational Safety and Health Administration.
Again, Madam Chair, the issue that held up the work session on this budget before were the budget reductions that are recommended in Policy Option Package 090, and you will see that on page 51. And again, Debbie, if you would walk through those.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Debbie Lincoln again for the record. The reductions that we're recommending are $2,287,850, 17 positions and 17 FTE. This includes elimination of the Worksite Redesign Program. This program is a grant program to employers to identify safety issues in their workplaces and request assistance from the Oregon Occupational Safety and Health Division to find solutions to those ergonomic, mostly ergonomic problems, safety and health problems. There are three positions in this reduction for $417,211. It would also reduce a corresponding $4 million in the Workers' Benefit Fund, which are the grants themselves. The second reduction we're recommending is to reduce administration by abolishing two positions for a budget saving of $287,652. One of the management positions was recently vacated. It was at one point in the training budget. We've already made arrangements to shift those duties to other administrative staff and are proceeding with that reduction. We also recommended reducing the consultative program by eliminating actually six consultants total for a reduction of $845,357. Four of the consultants are funded by a federal grant at 90%. We are recommending this reduction because the grant itself causes a great deal of administrative work, duplicative reporting, duplicative computer systems, those kinds of things. The other two consultants are funded completely with the premium assessment operating account. And we're recommending reducing the enforcement program by six enforcement staff funded entirely by the premium assessment operating account state fund for $737,630.
Thank you, Ms. Lincoln. Representative Johnson. The last time that I spoke with, forgive me, I don't remember whether it was one of the committee staff, and I apologize for not remembering which one. You were going to meet with selected members of this committee to see if there were any options besides eliminating the consulting positions. Were those conversations productive? Did any other options occur as a result of those conversations?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, there really are a number of ways to cut this pie. There are a variety of options that we could look at other programs that could be reduced or eliminated, other kinds of payments. I think as, and then I did talk to a couple of members of the committee about those. I think the, at this point, we are back to the governor's revised budget recommendation, and I'm ready to talk about anything the committee would like to talk about, but this continues to be our recommendation.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, part of the problem here is that we are looking at two different sources of funding for some of these adjustments that could be made, and we currently have an agreement on the part of the Management Labor Advisory Committee as to the reductions that that they have approved, and ultimately the decision was to go forward with that recommendation given the difficulty at this point in trying to reach some consensus on other kinds of shifts or other kinds of program funding.
I have a direct comment from those who've met with the MLAC people. MLAC says a deal is a deal and doesn't want to revisit the issue. Or Senator Dukes.
I was the one in the meeting that we had, and I now know a lot more about workers' comp and OSHA than I ever wanted to know. Thank you. I came in today prepared with three motions, and we would just go down them because I know these positions can be saved, and particularly there's six of them that frustrated me a lot in this budget. But the agency is stuck. And I believe that MLAC would agree to go along with one of the proposals that they would need to agree to. But the legislative process is what the legislative process is, and I'm not going to make those motions this morning. There are things going in this building, and you make your choices, and after some deliberation, I decided this was not a battle I was going to take on. It's very frustrating to me because there is a legitimately honest, straightforward, fairly easy way to save six consultants, and we're not to go there. So I think that the Croat Research Project is a good one. However, the fact that it sustains no cuts, and we're going to take out six compliance officers and six consultants. So people need to remember that workers' comp and OSHA at least, was set up to keep workplaces safer for employees. And in doing that, we help make sure people stay on the job, and the redesign helps get people back to work who normally would not be able to lead a fulfilling life. This is the sort of thing that causes divorces and torn apart families, because people don't feel like people anymore when suddenly they can't work and it's not their fault. And I got to walk away from this. And I think there are people who have forgotten that that's what OSHA is all about, and are willing to walk away from that. They're in positions that I'm not in. And so that's what it's going to be, and the research facility is going to be fully funded. And the actual on-the-ground programs are going to take cuts.
Senator Dukes, I want to thank you for your work on this.
Glad to do it, Madam Chair, but I have to tell you that when we put together a program and we give people reasons to believe that we're doing good things for Oregonians, we need to continue to remind ourselves why we're doing it and to keep that mission out in front of them, and I truly believe that this session we are failing in that.
Thank you, Senator. Any further discussion with the committee? Debbie, were you through with your presentation?
I'm finished.
Yes, Robin.
With that, Madam Chair, my recommendations are on page 2 of my memo and page 4 of the spreadsheet. The Legislative Fiscal Office is recommending approval of the current service level of $36,852,276 other funds, 236 positions, and 235.08 FTE. This includes the standard reductions for PERS and the $2,287,850 and 17 positions in FTE that Debbie just discussed. Legislative Fiscal Office is also recommending approval of a reduction of $1,087 in out-of-state travel. And with that, Legislative Fiscal Office recommends approval of a budget of $36,851,189 other funds, 236 positions, and 235.08 FTE.
Madam Chair, I'd move that we approve the Legislative Fiscal Office recommendation for the Oregon Occupational Safety and Health Administration at $36,851,189, 236 positions, 235.08 full-time equivalency.
Discussion. Any objections? If not, so moved. And thank the committee again. This has been a difficult budget for all of us, and I think Senator Dukes has spoken a great deal of concern many have had. Appreciate all the work the committee's done. Next, we'll do the Division of International Corporate Securities. I'll tell you what, before we go into this work session, we'll take a 5-minute break.
Madam Chair, we'll be aware of this.